The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Lisa Bodell. Lisa is the founder and CEO of FutureThink, a company that uses simple techniques to help organizations embrace change and increase their capability for innovation. She has worked with such organizations as Google, Accenture, and more. She is the author of Kill the Company and her newest book, Why Simple Wins. She sits on boards such as Novartis' Diversity and Inclusion Board and the Global Advisory Council for the World Economic Forum. Lisa Bodell, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I just got back from the Aspen Ideas Festival this past Sunday because Second City was presenting as part of the it was really cool. We're part of the Spotlight Health program for a project we're doing with Caring Across Generations that's going to provide improvisational training for caregivers. And I was reading your book in between. Oh, you know what? I'm going to back up. Something was crackly on your end. Are you?
Yeah. What's the deal? I don't know. Okay.
I'm going to start. I'm going to start over on the question.
Got it.
Here we go. I just got back from the Aspen Ideas Festival this past Sunday because Second City's presenting as part of the Spotlight Health Program, and it's for a project we're doing with Caring Across Generations that's going to provide improvisational training for caregivers. And I was reading your book in between the various sessions that I was attending, and it was
My apologies.
No. It was kind of perfect because so many of the discussions were about how we have made the healthcare process in this country too complex for everyone, and the best programs are the simple ones. And so they were, in effect, preaching your sermon, right?
Love. Oh, good. Give them a book or tell them to call me. I want to put them in charge of my training now. This is great. They can understand.
Yeah, because I would say, so what I want to start with is the underlying problem. And I love this quote from your book. You say, quote, "We've made a sport about talking about how busy we are."
Oh, my God, have we ever. Yeah. And you know, one of the things I talk about in my book also is like, we choose complexity and we don't realize it. And one of the things about being busy is it's become so ingrained in terms of how we talk about things because busy is important. And, you know, this anecdote I talk about when I do training is think about it. 20 years ago when someone said, you know, Kelly, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. You'd say, I'm great. Mm-hmm. And maybe 10 years ago, if someone said, hey, how are you doing? They'd say, you know, I'm good, good, hanging in there. Today, if someone asks you how you're doing, what do you say?
Oh, I'm so busy.
And that becomes a busy off, right? You think you're busy. I'm busy. Oh, my God. You know, I have 3 cell phones. I answer email, my sleep, you know, because busy is I'm valued. Mm. And if I'm not busy, I must not be contributing or have value. And we say that reward system even in our companies. No one gets rewarded or promoted for less, right? So they get promoted and valued for more people, more geographies, more products, more this. So, you know, we create the beast that we become a slave to. And that's how things, you know, like folks working in healthcare, that's how that happens. We're busy because we value more.
And is this because of technology or is that just a not side benefit to make things even worse?
Yes. Okay. You know, and everyone says to me, is technology a help or a hindrance when it comes to simplicity? And the answer is yes, because it helps us. I mean, I look at my phone, right, and I see all these apps I have that help me do a specific task at a specific time. And, you know, I can download music. I can reserve a restaurant. All that kind of stuff is great because it simplifies my life. I can do things faster. At the same time, the problem with humans is just because we can doesn't mean we should. So we send one more email because it's so simple to do. We actually can get online at any time. So we become addicted to that. We can actually be, we're available 24/7 because we can't. And so it also creates this layer of complexity. I think we have to start to put down boundaries around it so we know when it's a help and when it's not.
Yeah, the thing I've been saying to people is, you know, I'm 50 years old, and when I was growing up as a kid, I did not wear a seatbelt. No one wore seatbelts.
Right.
You would never, ever today consider putting your kid in a car without a seatbelt, and we need seatbelts for our digital devices.
I love that you said that, and I think that's the kind of thing, Kelly, I think is going to start to happen with people, because they're starting to just like cognitively max out, and it's starting to show, right, in terms of our stress and all this other stuff. You probably see it with people performing all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the best performers are the ones that can do things simply, and I think the best performers at work are the ones that can get things done simply and not be overloaded and stuff. So I actually wonder if in the future human resource people, their job is going to be to put these boundaries down.
Oh, I hope so. I mean,
I hope so too. It is.
It's a thing where we seem to have devalued deep work. You know, the idea of taking your time and crafting something, you know, beautifully. And we're very lucky in the arts because you can't rush a symphony. You can't rush a theatrical process. When you do, everyone knows it turns to shit.
And then you have
a line in the book where you say complexity actually destroys, or can destroy, a full tenth of company profits every year. Is that true?
It is true. It's so true. And it's, well, it, you know, I want to talk a little bit about this because I think complexity, of course, has financial issues, but there's many more than that that I think are more important. And let's get to that next. But yes, it can, a full tenth of profit, because we're not focusing on the work that matters. Mm-hmm. We are focusing on busy work, not on better work. And so that does destroy things in terms of, you know, everyone does these audits of how many hours are wasted in meetings. It's the wasted time or the opportunity cost of spending time and stuff that doesn't matter where you could have been innovating or doing things that are slower and more thought out and have bigger vision to them. But the thing in companies that really boggles my mind is that thinking has become a daring act. Hmm. That's really the problem. And because we value doing over thinking. And I tell this story about how, and this is how the busy work happens. People go, well, envision this, Kelly. I go to see Bob. I need his help on something really important. And, you know, I'm so busy. I've got stuff going on. And I go to his office, and there he is. And there's Bob. He's got his feet up on his desk, and he's looking out the window and just smiling. And I say, Bob, what are you doing? And Bob goes, oh, I'm sorry. I was just thinking. Just thinking. And what's the first thing that pops into most people's head when I tell that story? Get back to work.
Yeah.
Right? Get back to work. So, you know, this whole thinking thing is the opposite of working. That's how we think of it. So we say we want thinking time, but we clearly don't value it, or we're jealous of people that do it. And that perception needs to change.
Yeah. You also have a really terrific example that I think almost every person who works in a business can relate to. And I love the Second City accounting department. Let me go on the record and say they're all lovely, smart, giving, good people. So I'm not talking about them. They pay my check. I want it to keep coming. But you do say in the book, quote, an accounting department has a system in place to process expense reports. Is the system set up to simplify the experience of those submitting their expenses, or is it set up so that the accounting department can process the reports most efficiently? You know the answer.
Yeah, you know the answer. So that's the other thing about simplicity, which is in service of who. And what happens so much in companies, well, any organization, which is, because we're so busy doing, because we're so busy micromanaging, we have traded the telescope for the microscope. So we can't have the vision because we're too busy analyzing the little details to get things done more effectively, more efficiently. And that makes us turn inward, right? We're doing a lot of navel gazing versus stargazing. And so to your point, I'm sure the accounting people say, look how efficient we are. But they're not the customers. You are.
Right.
So that's a mental change that needs to happen.
Yeah. And it's not even to say that you shouldn't look into those things, but balance is so essential. And my partner on my book, Tom Yorton, used to always say, and it would drive us crazy, but actually I miss it, because he would always say when we get down a rabbit hole in terms of business conversation, he'd go, what is the problem we're trying to solve?
That's right.
And
That's exactly right.
So it's this idea of looking at presuppositions. So, you know, why are we even in the room in the first place? Have we thought about that? Or, you know, we've now gone down the line with this thing. Do we even remember why this initiative was begun? Because it's changed so many times.
That's right. And the thing that I always talk about with simplification, or saying it a better way, killing complexity, which is we have to start to question assumptions. Like, we start to go down a rabbit hole, but we forget to ask the question of why we're even there in the first place, like you said. And a lot of the times with complexity, it's similar, which they think people just assume that because it's the way we've always done it, that rule must be in place for a reason. We don't question things anymore. And until we learn that it's okay to question assumptions and we create an environment where that's okay to have that happen, we don't know the difference between a groove and a rut. And teaching people to actually ask better questions, to question the assumptions around how we work, that's how we start to simplify things, because there are much better ways to solve problems. We just are getting too complacent to do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and this reminds us, it reminds me of the conversation that you and I had around this. And full disclosure, I am mentioned very briefly in the book.
Yes, you are. I love it. I was so happy you were.
But you would come on anyway. It's not just because I'm in there. But okay. I think the conversation was partly this, too, which is what I know that has been so successful at Second City is that when we're creating our very rich content, it goes through a simplification process, which it could be as deep as there are too many words in the sentence and it's not funny enough because we're over complex, you know, and there's, that's really what we're doing is simplifying and simplifying and simplifying to get to the important thing, because you know the shortest distance between two people is a laugh. And that is the, and so when you get it right, there's nothing better. But you know, a very great writer said brevity is the soul of wit. And so we know this from our art, and we need to put that art into our business.
Well, hence the reason why I wanted to talk to you. You know, it's so funny because people say to me, wait a minute, why do you have him from Second City in your book? And then when I explain it, they go, oh my God, I said, you know, people that are improv, they have to be agile, think on their feet, be resilient, bounce back, which by the way, are all the key traits that you're teaching in leadership today in businesses. And I said, you know, of course it makes total sense because the performer has to be able to stick the landing immediately. And to do that, you have to get a complex point across simply. And that learning from you, Kelly, was really interesting to me how performers do it directly can translate to business. Because I think we value more. And by complicating it, the message gets lost, right? We don't know the difference between signal and noise. And that's what I'm trying to do in this book, which is there's lots of different ways to simplify. And one of them is minimize, which is the thing you said, like just get to the point.
Yep.
The other thing is, like you said, with too many words, it could be about clarity, right? Just don't get rid of your jargon. Just say what you want to say. It could be about transparency, right? In performance, you build on each other by collaborating, not by hiding your skill or being the only one that does something. And it can also be about making it repeatable so other people can share in it and do it again and again. So there's lots of ways to simplify that are easy to do. There are small changes that can make a big difference, and it can help everyone on every level either be a better performer or improv person or better agile business person.
Yeah, the jargon is big, right? So
huge.
We work with so many different corporations in Second City Works, our corporate division, and we have to get inside their business. And what I tell this to younger colleagues all the time, which is you got to call out when you don't understand what's being said in the room. Because it will help them. And you know, don't be worried about looking stupid, because quite frankly, I don't understand half the jargon that gets said to me in these meetings. And then when they realize that, then they're like, oh, wait, are we talking like that to our actual audience? Because if we are, they don't understand us.
That's exactly right. And that's that understanding part. Most people, again, with the complexity part, everyone thinks it's about just doing less. It could just be about clarifying it.
Yeah.
So, for example, let me give you an example. One of the things we talk about in the book was around GE and their legal department. By the way, no one thinks that the legal department can simplify anything.
Right.
That's their assumption. They're the department of no is what they think.
Yep.
Well, basically, they said, let's take a 100-page contract, our average 100-page contract for this one, you know, manufacturing thing they did, and get it down to one page. I mean, something big and bold and hairy and audacious, one page. And they did. And the problem was they got it so simplified, and they replaced everything with jargon that no one understood what it was. So they then increased the contract back up to 10 pages. And at first they felt like, you know, a bunch of losers. Oh, we didn't do it. 10 pages is significantly better than 100 pages.
Right.
And by getting rid of the jargon, they not only cut a lot of the crap out from the original stuff, but then they had something that was clear and easy for people to get stuff done. So it is about minimizing, but it's clarity too. People need to understand what the hell you're asking them to do.
Yep. All right. There's a big idea in your book that I want to dig into, because I bristled when I first read it, and then I converted to.
Now I'm scared.
Okay. You say if you get the work right, you get the culture right.
Why did you bristle?
because I'm a culture guy. Well, I thought I was a culture guy, right? I mean, Second City has this incredibly rich culture that I talk about all the time. But then, upon reflection, honestly, I struggle with this because I'm like, why am I bristling to it? But then what I realized is, and there was always this case at Second City, even from when I started there in the 80s, was that there was a blue-collar sort of lunch pail aspect to the work where you know, it's like, this art isn't magic. This art is coming from our work. And I'm like, oh, no. This culture is emanating from the work, because the work is right, and the culture does follow, and the culture is rich and all that. But if we don't get the work right, there ain't no culture to fall back on.
Bingo. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was interesting. I was talking with a client of mine at P&G, and she was one of the ones that talked to me about work right, culture right. And it really just, it was like a light bulb, a lightning bolt just hit me. And I said, God damn, that's right. Because I feel like, as someone who runs an innovation firm, I spend all my time hanging out with people that are a bunch of posers when it comes to culture. Mm-hmm. And this is what I mean, that just because you have colored walls and organic food and, you know, chairs shaped like hands and all this other stuff, that does not mean you're innovative. That means you have a nice work environment, but you're focused on cultural aesthetics. That's what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So I think people want inspiring places to work, for sure. But I think that what they really want is inspiring work. And so if I'm spending all my days in meetings and emails and PowerPoint, that is not inspiring work, no matter how colorful the walls are and no matter how many whiteboards you have. But if I spend my work, my life doing, or my day doing really inspiring work, you know, I'm happy that I have organic food in the cafeteria, but I'm really happy that I'm working on things that move the needle and make a difference. So I want people to make that shift. I want them to focus on, get the work right, guys. Cut the crap. People will stay.
Yep. Simon Sinek was on the podcast, and he has a great quote that is connected to this, which is, customers will never love a company until the employees love it first.
That's right.
And, you know, like, again, you don't really fall in love with the culture. You fall in love with the work. And that is a human behavior thing.
It's a human behavior thing. So we, you know, all humans really run on very simple things: risk, fear, power, control, love, trust. And those are the things that make us do what we do every day. Like, that, we don't ask for more PowerPoint slides because we really want more data. We have a fear. That's what drives us. You know, yeah. There's those kinds of things. We don't give out data not because we want to be the expert, but because we want to control and have mm-hmm. safety. So when we really figure out those drivers, we can change the work. So we got to really, yes, we have to pay attention to the human behaviors. But by doing that, we have to pay attention to the work.
Yeah. And I was thinking about this when we were in Aspen, because one of the improv concepts that we are laying on the caregiving situation, and this ties into work, you're going to get why it ties into work, which is, we talk about ensembles rather than teams. And what we are saying in the caregiving context is, you've got to realize, if you are a caregiver, that you actually are operating inside an ensemble. It isn't all on you. This is the ensemble includes the person you're caring for. It includes their doctor. It includes their relatives. It includes their community that they live in. And when you move to an ensemble mindset, lots of people come in and outside of those ensembles. They enter them. They leave them. The ensemble itself are rules around the behavior inside the ensemble, as opposed to teams, which compete and you know, disband and all that. So when you think of your even in a work context, as your work pod as an ensemble, then you're going to have some agreements on human behavior. In an improv context, that's like, we're going to say yes and. We're not going to say no to each other. We're going to have each other's back. We're going to be focused on the needs of the person in front of us and not our own needs, right? All these rules that really make for healthy collaboration to make great content and great shows, but they can also be used to simply make work better.
Totally agree. And I'll tell you, so I'm writing the book, and I'm coming up with all these tools to help people simplify their work. And you know what? At the end of the day, it became the best tool. And the last one we did was when we wrote a simplification code of conduct. Because what it was is, you know, I can tell you all day long, Kelly, I can give you, and we have it, 100 ways to simplify your email,
yep,
your PowerPoint, your meetings, all that stuff. And where people are like, that's a great idea. So that's one thing. But what really it came down to is changing the behavior. And when you start to talk about a code of conduct, because everyone has to agree to it, right? It included things like, similar to what you said, I will not create false urgency. I will say no to things. I have permission and am empowered and expected to eliminate things that don't matter. Yep. I will actively seek out redundancies. I mean, I have a whole list of them.
Yep.
But it's so interesting. We go through a whole training day with people around killing complexity. Mm-hmm. The one that evokes the most emotion, empowerment, and commitment is creating this code of conduct together. Because if we all do it together, it's not that we can call each other out on it, more it's that we know that we are empowered to do it. Because it's one thing if the boss says you can say no to a meeting, but what typically happens is people won't do it because they're still afraid. But if we all start to do it, then we all start to move in the same direction.
Yeah, and you talk about that with regard to leadership, that that a leader has to have essentially an intuitive sense of simplicity.
They do.
And if they don't, it's never going to happen.
It's not going to happen. But also, too, they have a minimal, I call it a minimalist mindset. They're okay with less, right? Their ego isn't driven by more. They actually want less because they know that meaningful work, not busy work, matters. But the other part about it is they have to mirror the behavior they want others to do. Because you know that boss that always is like, you know, I'm all about saying no, and then they never do. Well,
right.
No one else is going to do it either.
Nope.
So you have to do the behaviors first, and then other people will do it. It's too risky.
You have a cool thing, too, that I want to tease out a little bit, where you say that leaders need to depart from the need to seek consensus.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, that's risk-taking.
So that's cool. And especially because I think that someone might read that and say that, oh, you know, that means you don't want input. No. You want to ask a lot of questions of a lot of different people.
That's right.
You just don't want to then rely on consensus because that gets you to average at best.
And also it's a yes man situation, right? I want everyone to be happy. Basically I call it hugging the middle. It's you know, here we are, you know, we had a great idea and we had some shitty ideas, but now if we just kind of mishmash it together, right, now we'll get a very mediocre idea that everybody's not happy with. I mean, what's the point, right? So I think that we need to give people empowered and be passionate about fighting for their ideas and questioning things. And if all we do is want to make everybody happy and get consensus, it will never, ever happen. It creates complacency.
Mm-hmm.
You see it everywhere.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Dollar Shave Club guys.
Yeah.
They're really interesting. And the reason I bring this up is I just got someone found me on Twitter and said, have you seen this article? And I hadn't. And they were interviewed a couple days ago. And the quote from Mike Dubin is, quote, I think there's a lot about studying improv that can help you in business. Absolutely. Just the ability to tease out of thin air the most important ideas, the most resonant ideas in any setting is something you hone in improv.
Totally agree.
Yeah. And what I liked about that is it's talking about teasing out thin air, all this idea of this, you know, the world is very complex. And so it is the job of successful people to make it less so and to find those really, really wonderful things. And that doesn't mean that you don't create abundance. Abundance is there. Create abundance. It's just, right? It's just changing your orientation to bring things down to make them workable.
Yeah, and I have to say, people like it because there's a very positive feeling that comes with simplicity.
Yeah.
There's confidence, there's relaxation, there's inspiration. Like, people are inspired by it, right? I don't know anyone that looks at complexity is like, oh, thank God. I mean, yes, are some things complex? Yes, building a plane is complex.
Mm-hmm.
But it shouldn't have to be built a different way every single time. That's really the point. I'm not saying complex things don't exist, but how we go about them shouldn't be complex every time.
Right.
I think what's really interesting for people is we are getting to a point where we've always valued more. But I think that now the tipping point is pretty soon people are going to say, I can't take it anymore, right? I have to create the space. I need that open space to happen. How do I do it? And, you know, I'll tell you, this has been a real tipping point for me because – you know, I've had an innovation business for 20 years, and I'll tell you, my trainers couldn't figure out why it was so hard for people consistently to move the ball forward in their companies with innovation. They're smart. They get paid a lot of money. They have the resources. They have great brands. What the fuck is going on?
Yep.
But basically, what was happening is they didn't have the time. Not that they couldn't do it. They didn't have the time. So we needed to simplify so they could create that space for the real work to happen. So I have to say, I've actually shifted away from a lot of the innovation stuff because it's not going to work until we get rid of the stuff that's not working.
Oh, that's interesting. So you talked, too, about this idea around simplification as habit. And as I think we keep discovering in our various conversations with thought leaders on this podcast, is that this is crucial because we as human beings are governed by our habits. We're going to have them no matter what. So how do you have some ideas for us in terms of how you can make what's a couple of these? How do you make simplification a habit?
Well, so it's kind of like with improv, right? You can't just learn it and it's a one and done.
Right.
It's got to be top of mind. So one of the things we do, here's the simplest one you could do, is you give people permission to kill rules and you expect them to do it. And so the reason I say rules is because it's pretty broad and it allows people to look at things that aren't working and say, why are we doing them? What if we didn't, right? Yeah. How would I stop something? And so what's interesting is people really embrace this. Because if you ask people what gets in their way of getting something done, or if there are any stupid rules in their company they'd love to get rid of, sit down, because they're going to give you an earful for hours. I've never had a session where we've said, tell me the rules you'd like to kill, where we haven't come up with literally 100 of them. So that's one of the ways you can make it a habit, is you instill these very simple practices like kill a stupid rule, where, for example, at Sprint, every week people had to come to the meeting and have at least one rule killed. At HBO, they had to annually build that into their strategic planning, that it wasn't about creating next year's plan. It was also about getting rid of stuff that wasn't working through killing rules. So institutionalizing that and keeping that as a quick habit is an easy thing you can start doing right now on your own. You don't need a team to do it.
Right. Oh, that's really great. Yeah, and again, you know, I know everyone's like, well, wait a second, aren't you all about yes and? It's like, yes and is the front end of innovation. It is think of it as that brainstorm that you have, because everything after yes and is really lovely, empowering no's. You know, it is killing off all those ideas that we said were fantastic and they could allow to live in the room. And the sweetness of this is that people, because they had their idea vetted, they tend to then not hang on to them so much and feel like, oh, that was my one good idea. Because, look, if you're holding on to one good idea, that ain't enough.
I love to be able to use yes and in a subtractive way, too. This is what's different. Innovation, people tend to think of it as a plus, whereas simplification is about subtraction, getting minimalized.
Yeah.
So I would say with kill a stupid rule, can we kill this rule? Yes, and we could also do this one, and we don't have to do this, and we don't. So it's adding on more getting rid of things versus adding more things. I love the and in that context.
Yeah, me too. That's really cool. All right, I can't believe these things go so quickly. All right, so we always ask for a yes and story from our guest, and this goes back to the most basic rule of improvisation, which is to build something out of nothing with a group of people. You can't say no, and you can't just rely on yes. You have to say yes and. I know you a little bit. You are a yes and person, but I'm wondering if you have a story from your work or life that would illustrate the point.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, and. I'll tell you a personal one. Good. I can tell you a business one, too, but yes, and. I was starting my business. I was very scared. This was 20 years ago, and I was a recovering ad agency person, but I knew that I wanted to start my own business and make money in my sleep. And basically, I put together a business plan, and I said, here's what I want to do. I want to start doing innovation research, and I want to put it together and sell it. And I packaged up this whole business plan, and I went out to people that were my mentors, and they hated it. Basically, they hated every bit of it. It dashed my dream. Mm-hmm. And I sat down with them, and I said, what can I do? And they sat down with me, and they said, we're going to make this only a positive conversation, basically what you're doing with me now. Mm-hmm. They said, so what could you do with this that would make you happy? And I said, well, I could also do training. And they said, and I said, and I could sell them together. So if I do my training, then they would buy the tools. And I said, and then if people really liked it, I could turn it into a book. And they said, and basically we sat there the whole time, and we together by saying, and I really realized all the things that I thought just by doing one thing would be enough. They actually helped me put out my business plan and added more over time. So it was very cool. What I thought I originally was going to do wasn't at all what I ended up doing, because they made me say and to more things.
That's great. I think for a lot of people, you know, the yes is such a big part, because we get said no to all the time. But really, in this, as you get a little more sophisticated in this work, it's the and that is the kind of crucial thing. It's harder.
I totally agree. What I could have taken away from the conversation was they hated my stuff and it was shit. But what they really did was they pushed me in new directions. And if I had questioned it, and were more open to possibilities, I wouldn't be where I am today. And it wasn't about just adding on a ton of stuff. It was adding on better stuff, which I liked.
Love it. The book is called Why Simple Wins. Everyone should get it. It's awesome. Lisa Bedell, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. I had a great time. When I've been working in a coal mine.